Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week, the nation celebrates American independence, and we at Talking History will mark the annual event by looking at what this show is all about, history, especially American history, or the study of our past. Distinguished historian Eric Foner will be our guest, and he and Talking History's Fred Nielsen will discuss how history's written, why our view of past events often changes, and why history matters in the first place. And after that, also on the subject of how we view the past, Kathleen McDonough will give us her thoughts on constructing historical documentaries. But first, in another of his moments in time, Dan Roberts tells us about the individual who is often identified as the first person to die in the war for American independence.
On March 5, 1770, in Boston, Massachusetts, British soldiers led by Captain Preston fired into an unruly crowd of protesters. One of the first to fall was Crispus Attucks.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
All during the winter and spring of 1770, tension in Boston had been building between citizens and British soldiers sent there to prevent unrest. Many American workers were resentful of the soldiers because they would take civilian jobs at cheaper rates when they were off duty. This, plus the general indignation of the city over the presence of troops, set up one of the first bloody confrontations of the Revolutionary period. Crispus Attucks was at 47 a 6-foot drifter, a mulatto, a light-skinned black man. Born around 1723, he served as a slave for many years, but had escaped by going to sea. Attucks was well known around the docks and was a powerful, intimidating physical specimen. On the day of the so-called Boston Massacre, in the early evening, a crowd began to harass a squad of Brits as they came to rescue one of their comrades surrounded at the Customs House on King Street. Crispus Attucks was at the head of the crowd. At the trial 6 months later, a slave named Andrew testified that a stout mulatto had waded in and struck one of the soldiers in the heat of the moment. The soldier turned and fired. Several more blasted into the crowd, and soon 5 men lay dead or wounded. Crispus Attucks was among the first to fall. John Adams, speaking later, said, "Not the Battle of Lexington or Bunker Hill, not the surrender of Burgoyne or Cornwallis were more important events in American history than the Battle of King Street on the 5th of March, 1770. And the first to fall at that most singular event was a man of color, Crispus Attucks. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Independence Day is so closely tied to July 4th, 1776, that we often refer to it as the 4th of July, as if everything happened on that one day. And at this time of the year, all the attention in the media only perpetuates that idea. So perhaps we'd best devote this segment of the program, our history in the news, to setting the record straight. Not only did the war for independence take 8 years, but also 2 months passed between the day on which the motion for independence was first made to the Continental Congress and the date on which the Declaration of Independence was actually signed. Taking up the second point, Richard Henry Lee entered a resolution for independence before Congress on June 7, 1776. It was seconded, but a vote postponed until a public statement or declaration of the reasons for independence could be prepared. That job was entrusted to a committee, led by Thomas Jefferson, who reported back with a draft of the document on June 28th. 4 days later, on July 2nd, the date that John Adams hailed as the day that thereafter would be celebrated as Independence Day, Congress adopted Lee's motion for independence. On July 4th, Congress adopted the committee's work, the Declaration of Independence, which was sent to the printer and signed on August 2nd. So there you have it. You have another month to celebrate. This is Talking History, always willing to help. It's become a popular sport, reporting just how little Americans know about their past, but it's also clear that as measured by the ever-increasing number of historical sites and museums and of the number of visitors to those places, as well as the heated debates over events in their past, history does matter to a large number of Americans. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, takes up the seeming paradox and other related matters with his guest, Eric Foner.
The success of the History Channel, the documentaries of Ken Burns, and numerous best-selling books of history remind us that the past is popular territory. Meanwhile, debates over museum exhibits, history standards and textbooks, historical revisionism, and the flying of the Confederate flag remind us that it's also contested territory. History obviously matters to large numbers of Americans. But why does it matter? Who should decide what parts of the past to emphasize and how they should be interpreted? These are among the questions addressed by my guest, Eric Foner, in his recent book, Who Owns History? Rethinking the Past in a Changing World. One of the nation's most eminent historians, Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and a past president of the American Historical Association. Professor Foner, welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
One of the themes of your book, Who Owns History, is that professional historians and the public often disagree about what kind of history we should have. What's the reason for that disagreement?
Well, I think there is a difference in how scholars in the field think about the writing of history and perhaps how many people who are very interested in history but are not obviously professionals do. Many people outside the academic world kind of see history as a collection of facts which more or less don't change over time. Therefore, the role of the historian is kind of to present these facts in as interesting and accessible a way as possible. We historians obviously think we should do that, but what we're interested in is changing interpretations, is new perspectives, new angles of vision on the past. I think a good example of this difference is the fact that in many cases outside the academic world, the term revisionist is a sort of term of abuse. In fact, President Bush just a couple of weeks ago used the term revisionist historians about people who were criticizing some of his, you know, policies vis-a-vis Iraq and some problems that have arisen there. As a criticism, in other words, people trying to change the past, whereas to us scholars, revisionism is what we do. That's the whole point, is to find new ways, new perspectives, new insights on past events. That's how we gain more understanding of the past. That's how our views of the past change. In other words, we take it for granted that interpretations of history are always changing, and that's necessary and desirable, whereas many people, not everybody outside the academic world, sort of think, well, no, there's one set of facts, and that's it, and the job of the historian is to tell it to us.
In the 90s, history was caught up in the so-called culture wars. And I wonder if that conflict has overall been good or bad for history. On the one hand, when people argue about the use and interpretation of the past, it seems to prove that history matters, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, there are those who seem totally alienated from what historians, particularly revisionist historians, to use it in the pejorative sense, are doing.
Well, historians were very surprised when we and the study of history suddenly became a kind of a battlefront in these culture wars, which ranged all across, as you remember, through, you know, works of art and literature and postmodernism and things like that. But, you know, this came to a head in the mid-90s in the whole debate over the national history standards. People like Lynn Cheney and others, conservatives, sort of denounced recent ways of writing and teaching American history as depressing, as she said, or focusing too much on the history of ordinary people, not enough on great scholars, great individuals, great leaders in American history. You know, I think it's calmed down, that debate, and that's probably a good thing. At the time, it did direct attention to how the study of history has changed, and I think that's salutary. The fact is that in the last generation or two, historians have devoted far more attention to groups that had been more or less neglected in previous writings of history. I mean, when I studied history in school, you know, we got basically what they call the presidential synthesis. We went from president to president, and, you know, that was a pretty easy way of organizing the past. It was pretty simple, but it neglected a tremendous amount about how history works, and groups like African Americans, women, were just excluded almost entirely from this narrative. Today, perhaps, and Ms. Cheney made this point, we've gone too far in the other direction. Maybe all the work on these specific groups, ethnic groups, immigrant groups, etc., have lessened the sense of any coherent narrative structure to American history. I mean, to my mind, and I try to do this in my own work, the task at hand is to reintegrate American history into a coherent picture. That does not mean going back to the old view that just presidents and generals and Supreme Court justices are the cast of characters in history. What we have to do is create a narrative that brings together the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and the Lincolns with the runaway slaves, the fighters for women's suffrage, the birth control advocates, the labor activists. They're all part of American history, and you can't exclude either of those types of characters from the narrative. So to the extent that the history wars focused attention on this debate, I think that was good. Unfortunately, since these attacks were largely motivated by a political impulse to, you know, create a sort of super patriotic history, I think they shed a lot more heat than light on how history really ought to be thought about and taught.
Much of your own work as a historian focuses on Reconstruction, an interest that I find out from your book goes back at least as far as a presentation you made to your ninth grade American history class.
Correct.
Why is Reconstruction so important?
Well, you know, everybody thinks that the period they study is sort of the crux, the turning point of history, and I think that Reconstruction is critical to understanding American life and where we are today as a society 130, 40 years since that period. Reconstruction is the moment, the era after the Civil War, when the United States, for the first time, tried to come to terms with the prospect of having a truly interracial democracy. It was the first time that the rights of African Americans were put on the national agenda. The Constitution, the laws were rewritten to try to guarantee equal civil rights, equal political rights for African Americans, most of them, of course, being recently emancipated slaves. It was an experiment in interracial democracy. It was an amazing thing in the mid-19th century to try to create a situation where recently freed slaves actually exercised a modicum of real power in the society. It didn't work. Reconstruction was overthrown. There were violent groups like the Ku Klux Klan, you might say our own homegrown experience of terrorism, which used assassination, violence to overturn Reconstruction. And a long period followed in which these rights were taken away, basically. That's why we needed a civil rights movement in the mid-1950s and 1960s, which was sometimes called the Second Reconstruction. So if you're interested in the origins of civil rights, in the enduring problem of race in America and inequality, you've got to look at Reconstruction both in terms of what was attempted and why it didn't work, to really understand how we got to the point where in the late 20th century, we needed another such struggle to gain rights which supposedly had been guaranteed a century before.
This seems to be another place where there's a split between what professional historians think is important and what the public knows and thinks is important. This is a period Reconstruction that you know many Americans know very little about and may not even be able to identify. What explains that apparent lack of understanding, and what are its consequences?
Well, you're absolutely right, of course. I found it disheartening, since I wrote a 600-page book on the subject, that soon after that appeared, public opinion polls showed that almost no Americans knew anything about Reconstruction. But, you know, there is a gap between what we scholars tend to be interested in, and the general public, if you look at the bestsellers of history nowadays, many of them are very fine books, but they are on subjects that would have been familiar 50 years ago, the Lewis and Clark expedition, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, the Civil War, battle after battle of the Civil War, the Founding Fathers, books about, you know, Jefferson, etc. These are traditional subjects. There's nothing wrong with them, but there is a market for those kinds of books. There's much less of a market for what historians are really today doing. Studies of the origins of slavery, studies of civil war, studies of changes in family structure, things like that. You don't find them on the bestseller list. So there is this gap. I think it behooves us as historians to try to make our work as accessible as possible to a broad audience and not write, as unfortunately some do, in a way that is so academic and convoluted that only a few other scholars can really read and enjoy the work. But it's also true that many people who read these best-selling books are looking for a kind of heroic history. They're looking for a history of great achievement, which is fine, of great leaders. Reconstruction is not a history of great achievement. I mean, it was an amazing struggle of ordinary former slaves to gain their rights. But ultimately, Reconstruction is a story of failure, of violence, of the country not living up to its supposed ideals of freedom and equality. That's not an uplifting story, and it's not the kind of thing that people are going to run out to their bookstore and buy in order to make them feel happy about America.
One could argue, lots of people have, that we're harmed by the history we forget, including certainly the history of Reconstruction. So it's interesting to read in your book Nelson Mandela saying that the reconciliation in his country requires that South Africans forget the past.
Well, I wrote that essay. I was actually fortunate enough to be in South Africa at an academic conference just shortly, a few weeks after Mandela took office as president after the collapse of apartheid, a wonderful moment, you know, of opening, of freedom. And I was struck as a historian in Mandela's, in an interview just around the time of his inauguration, Mandela said, "We must forget the past." Now, what he meant was, we must not dwell on the injustices of the past. We must not be embittered by the terrible history this country has gone through. There is no point in wallowing in the past, in simply reliving it in order to stigmatize those who perhaps were guilty of serious crimes. He didn't mean forget the past in the sense that there should be no effort to uplift people who were downtrodden, but he was calling on people to think about reconciliation, think about ways of moving the country forward from a very dark era in its history. So on the one hand, as a citizen, you know, I say, right, you know, I appreciate what he's saying. He doesn't want us to become so morbid about past injustice that we can't really deal with the demands of the present and the future. On the other hand, as a historian, of course, forgetting the past is not the way I would suggest people go about thinking about their society. You do need to remember the past, even those injustices of apartheid. This doesn't mean you stigmatize all white people or all officials of the past government as evildoers, but you have to realize how the society got to where it is. And many people objected to that comment of his because the past is built into the present. In other words, if you go to South Africa, you will see vast inequalities, white people living in wealthy communities, well served by roads and public facilities and schools and water systems, etc., and millions of Africans living in squalid shanty towns with no modern conveniences. Well, why is that? That is the past still existing in the present. That is because past governments for generations built up the white areas and oppressed the African areas and made it impossible for Africans to benefit from the growth of the society. So that's still present. That's the past still living in the present. And one has to realize why these inequalities exist if one is going to try to address them, which is sure, I'm sure, is something Mandela understands.
Well, the past, Faulkner said, is not dead, and it's not even past.
It's not even past. That's the problem. It is still part. That's why we have to study history, because it is part of our present. The people who, a person who doesn't know, a society that doesn't know its own history is like a person with amnesia. You can function in the society without, you know, with amnesia. You can go about your daily life, but you really have no sense of who you are, of how you got to where you are, and that makes it impossible for you to think about the future. So a knowledge of the past is essential to understanding the society. That's why the study of history is important.
You write that an understanding of America can't be obtained purely from within America, and that globalization forces us to think about the United States history in new ways. How is that so?
Well, of course, one of the great paradigms or unstated assumptions of most writing in American history is what we call American exceptionalism, which is built in, that assumption is built into our culture and much of our writing. In other words, that America is so different from other countries, that our history is so different from that of other countries, that really we have nothing to learn from them. There is no point in learning the history of England, France, or Africa, or Asia, because it has no bearing on the United States, because we are a chosen, special people. Now, that rhetoric, I mean, you hear it today from the administration, that rhetoric is still alive and well in our country. But as a way of thinking about history, it's very limiting. It creates insularity. It creates chauvinism. America was formed from the earliest days by international processes, migration, empire, labor systems, you know, slavery, industrialism, whatever you name that is a key process in American history is an international process. That doesn't mean that you don't study how these things work out in different ways in different countries. But that essay of mine was really calling for scholars to expand their horizon and think about how events and processes in other countries might actually shed light on how we think about things that have happened in American history. So I'm calling for historians to be a little less parochial and expand their horizons beyond the borders, the physical borders of the United States, and think about how learning the history of other societies might actually give us greater insight into our own.
The title of your book, Who Owns History, poses a question. Who does own it?
Well, the wonderful thing about history is nobody owns it, and that's why it's the subject of conflict, that's why it's the subject of controversy. It's a democratic subject. You know, anybody can have ideas about history, which is great. You know, there are some subjects that's not the case of. You know, nuclear physics, how many people are really qualified or even think they can have an opinion about nuclear physics? You need an incredible amount of training. But history is democratic. Ordinary people can read history books. They can think about history. They go to history museums. So nobody owns history. History is always going to be a kind of a terrain of debate and battle about between different points of view, different interpretations, and that to me is what's exciting about it. There is no single truth with a capital T about history, and it's an evolving subject, and the way we think about history 50 years from now may be very different from the way we think about it today, and no one group, person, or even country has a lock, has a hold on how we think about history.
Well, Professor Foner, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Pleasure to talk to you.
I've been speaking with Eric Foner, the author of numerous books, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, The Story of American Freedom, and the book we've been discussing, Who Owns History? Rethinking the Past in a Changing World.
One of the most popular sources of information on the nation's past is the historical documentary. Our guest commentator this week, Kathleen McDonough, gives us a director's take on making those videos. What is the director's goal, and what do they do to engage their audience? McDonough, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, teaches at the State University of New York at Fredonia.
A goal of historical documentaries is to engage the viewer emotionally with the characters in the story. One way to create this emotional bond is to make the viewer feel an affinity for the subjects of the film. In my documentary, A World Inscribed, about how medieval manuscripts were produced, I tried to make these mostly anonymous artists come alive by stressing similarities between their lives and ours. For example, in the margins of the manuscripts themselves, I found complaints from the scribes about how boring the text was or how their hands hurt. One scribe sounded just like a clock watcher in a modern office when he wrote, "Thank God it will soon be dark." In another example, using quotes from primary sources, I directed the actor to reveal the possible motive behind the words. Here's a segment about how few people were literate in the early Middle Ages.
Few people, other than churchmen and those trained in church schools, knew how to read and write. Charlemagne, king of the Franks, who was crowned Holy Roman Emperor in 800 AD, tried to learn to write. His friend and biographer Einhard revealed,
"He used to keep writing tablets and notebooks under the pillows of his bed so that he could try his hand at forming letters during his leisure moments. But although he tried very hard, he had begun too late in life, and he made little progress."
I directed the actor performing Einhard to sound smug and condescending in order to stress the contrast between Charlemagne's exalted political position and his lack of scholarly achievement. Einhard may not have been the Holy Roman Emperor, but at least he could write. Another way I tried to create a bond with the viewer was to reveal the personalities of the scribes through camera moves. A segment is built around two self-portraits, one by a monk named Eadwine, and the other by a monk named Hugo. The first drawing of Eadwine writing at a desk takes up an entire page of the manuscript. In small letters around the portrait is the inscription, "I am the Prince of Scribes, and my fame shall live forever." I start the shot at his feet and slowly tilt up to his head. The camera move reinforces Eadwine's arrogance. His ego is so large, it doesn't fit in the frame. Hugo's portrait is small and surrounded by text. Here I start with a wide shot of the page and then zoom into the drawing. This movement emphasizes how self-effacing this portrait is compared to the one of Eadwine. The camera moves bring out the individuality of each scribe and help create a sense of recognition with the audience. These are some of the ways I try to make people from a distant past come to life.
You've been listening to Kathleen McDonough, an award-winning documentary filmmaker whose current video project is on the bicycle craze of the late 19th century. And finally, we continue our reading of the unpublished Civil War diary of Edwin R. Wilmarth, Union soldier in the 40th Massachusetts Infantry, who was captured and imprisoned at the infamous Andersonville prison in Georgia. In this week's segment, the prisoners, desperate for decent housing, are allowed to build new barracks, only to find out they aren't for them. August 27, 1864. Our detachment commenced to build barracks today. It's to be large enough to hold our whole number, 270 men. I can't make out the reason the Rebs are finally condescending as to permit us to erect something to make us comfortable. Our hopes have had quite a fall, as we think, if there was any prospect of us going out, that they would not build quarters for us, or rather let us build them. We now think we are in for all winter, or for life, as we know we cannot survive it anyway, as our clothes are all worn out, no boots, no blankets, and we are very weak and sickly. September 9th. Wonder of all wonders, we can now see why the Johnnies were so willing for us to build quarters. They wanted them for our sick, for a hospital, and thought they could kill us off, a few of us, I suppose, by overtasking us and at the same time getting the work out of us. While we're willing, the sick should have them, but it's hard to give up good quarters. The prisoners are going out there night and day, but there being 30,000 to 35,000 here, it will be some time before our own turn comes. I'm without shelter myself now, as my rubber blanket is gone, and have not had an opportunity to trade as yet my gold pen and pencil for a blanket. Not getting much meal and no wood at all for a few days past. Next time, Edwin R. Wilmarth and some of the other prisoners are told they are to be moved to another prison, but they don't get very far. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.